You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we'll find out why the word elite has become a dirty word in politics.
First, two lawmakers in Wisconsin are trying to close what some call the social host loophole. This so-called loophole allows adults to give alcohol to minors in their homes. The bill to eliminate the loophole was introduced by Representative Andre Jacques from Green Bay and Senator Van Wongert from Racine.
Senator Wongert joins us now. He's a Republican who represents the 21st Senate District, which includes Racine and Kenosha counties. Senator Wongert, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, good afternoon, Kate. How are you this afternoon?
Very well. So tell us, what is this so-called social host loophole?
Well, actually, there wasn't a loophole up until late last year when the court ruled on the definition of premises. Used to be, for all the years that I was in law enforcement, I retired back in 2001 with nearly 30 years in law enforcement, that the way the law was written, if you hosted a party at a residence, that was considered the premises of where the party was going on. And if there were underage persons there without a guardian or without their parent there providing them the alcohol, that those parents would be cited. They'd also be liable civilly for anything that happened with somebody that became intoxicated and left and maybe got in an accident or caused injury to somebody else. Well, this past year, the court took the definition of premises and applied it specifically to the licensing for a licensed premises, which would be like a tavern or something like that, where you can serve open intoxicants. So that would be like a tavern or something such as that.
Mm-hmm.
When they did that, it removed the home from being a premises because we don't license personal homes for you to be able to consume intoxicants in your home. So what this did is it changed that definition so that they've been challenging citations or not be able to issue citations for parents throwing parties for kids that are not accompanied by their parents. Because there is an exemption under state law that a parent can provide a alcohol to their child that's under 21 years of age, but they have to serve it to their individual child, and they have to, of course, make sure that their child doesn't become intoxicated, etc. Or it could be if, say, your spouse was 21 and you were not 21. Let's say you're 18, you got married young, but your spouse was 21. They could go into a tavern or a restaurant, order you a drink, and provide you with the drink because you're married, and that scenario is accepted by law.
So why do you think it should be a priority here to change this now?
Well, absolutely, not change it. Let's bring it back to where it was.
If you
serve intoxicants to underage persons and you're doing it knowingly, and that's an operative word, so if a parent is throwing a party, you know, for a whole bunch of underage persons that are not lawfully able to consume intoxicants, what's happening is, number one, we promote these young people consuming intoxicants. We have kids that are 12 years old that are indicating that they drink alcohol two or three times a week. These are 12-year-olds. You know, that this is acceptable conduct in the home, and it's not. And what's happening is we have more and more people becoming complacent about the effects of alcohol, and more of these young people are becoming violators of operating motor vehicles, et cetera, and, of course, when they're intoxicated, they're driving, more young people are being killed. So we need to make sure that parents have the responsibility that they're not serving to young people that should not be consuming those intoxicating beverages. So this would put the responsibility, would clarify that any adult, guardian, or property owner who knowingly allows or serves intoxicants to an underage person can be cited. And first violation is like $500,
mm-hmm.
and continuous or subsequent violations increase and can go all the way up to as high as $10,000 in addition to potential jail time.
Senator Wongert, your co-author, Andre Jacques, said it took a good bit of education with your colleagues there before this bill made it through committee. What was that process like?
Well, I think that there's an understanding. You know, some people think that this is okay to just But you're off the street, you're at somebody's house, so you can have a few drinks there and everything would be okay. And that might be okay if you had control over those individuals, that they wouldn't be leaving the home or getting in the car, and that their parents were aware that they were at a location and they were safe. I mean, so all those things in place might be okay, but they're not. Because what's happening is, when we say it's okay to consume in somebody's private residence, but then we have no responsibility for it, and these kids are allowed to leave and either get behind the wheel of cars or even be out walking, it becomes they become a target for issues that are going to affect their life later. So, and if you get an underage drinking citation, let me tell you, it becomes very difficult when you're hunting for jobs. When people see that on your record, if you've got two or three issues with alcohol, a lot of times they don't think that's very responsible, and they may not get the approval for a job position because of that. You know, so I mean, we need to put the priorities, you know, where they should be. That it is not acceptable for kids under the age of 21 to be consuming intoxicants without parental guidance or without their spouse there to make sure that it's done appropriately.
We're talking right now with Senator Van Wongard. He's a Republican who represents the 21st Senate District that includes Racine and Kenosha counties. He is co-author of a bill that would close the social host loophole here in Wisconsin. Senator, some people would say that because alcohol is banned completely for young people, they develop a poor relationship with alcohol once they're finally allowed to drink, leading to abuse and binge drinking. And the argument goes so far as to say that Europeans don't have that same drinking problem as Americans because alcohol is never totally off limits and moderate drinking is normalized. What do you say to that argument?
Well, I'll tell you, I was involved with working with Al-Anon and AA in Racine when I was younger. Actually, my wife and I started the Alateen program when we turned 18 in Racine. I dealt with alcohol issues my whole life and have seen it. I dealt with it as an accident reconstructionist, as a traffic investigator, and saw the effects of alcohol on individuals. And I would say this, that you know, some of these countries that they allow alcohol to be consumed by kids or underage persons, if you operate a motor vehicle, you lose your license and you're intoxicated. You lose your license for the rest of your life. So they have some pretty stiff penalties if you're not doing it appropriately and you don't have that parental guidance. We're not saying that you can't allow your child to experience a glass of wine or champagne at a wedding, but then it's got to be done by the parent, with the parent or guardian right there, so that they're assuming the liability and the responsibility that young individual is not becoming intoxicated and not becoming where it's a routine thing where they're consuming intoxicants. Because I will tell you that the frequency of young people who are consuming has increased. It has not gone down.
And I want to jump in here. Yeah, I want to get this question in. A similar bill was introduced in 2013. It failed to pass. What's different this time?
Well, I'll tell you, I wasn't there in 2013, or it probably would have passed. I'd gone through a recall, so I wasn't there when they did that specific piece of legislation. But I think it's all about educating individuals and educating my colleagues, because actually I don't believe we had I don't believe that the court ruling had come through yet at the time that piece of legislation was actually introduced. So now there's an explanation as to why this is needed, because of what the court's done. The court has defined a premises as being a person's home. You know, that a person's home doesn't meet the criteria of what they're calling a premises. Only a licensed premises, which would be a tavern or a restaurant, something like that's licensed to serve those intoxicating beverages or open intoxicants, would fall under that definition. So that's why it makes sense now.
So when you wrote the bill, did you look at any other places in the country for inspiration in crafting this bill?
I didn't specifically look at any other locations because I've dealt with this my whole career in law enforcement, and I wrote a lot of citations for individuals that were the occupants of a disorderly house and keepers of a disorderly house. That's where you do after hours and you have alcohol and you're serving it to minors. I wrote many of those citations where they had kid parties during my career. So I was already immersed in it and have the background in it. plus the alcohol background, too.
Senator Wongard, thank you so much for joining us today.
You are welcome. Thank you for bringing this important issue up. I appreciate it.
That was Senator Van Wongard, a Republican who represents the 21st Senate District, which includes Racine. He joined us to talk about the bill he's introduced with Representative Andre Jacques that would close the social host loophole in Wisconsin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we look at how the term elite has more social baggage than it used to.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
100 years ago, the United States entered World War I. For the next few months, we'll explore Wisconsin's part in the Great War.
The poem In Flanders Field was first published on December 8, 1915. Written by Canadian Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae, the poem quickly became a motivational mantra for recruiting troops and rallying the public behind the war effort.
Ellen Brooks is the oral historian at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum.
Many World War I veterans identified with the poem and remembered it throughout their lives. Veteran John Pavlik recited the poem from memory during an oral history interview around 1989.
And at this time, I'd like to recite Flanders Fields for you as it was written originally and America's answer to those who made the supreme sacrifice in Flanders Fields. The poem is very, very meaningful. It has it can be applied to all veterans of all wars, in any part of the world that it is being fought, by just substituting a word or two here and there. In Flanders fields, the poppies blow. Between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place. And in the sky, the larks still bravely singing fly, scarcely heard mid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe, to you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though the poppies grow in Flanders fields.
Over the years, there were a variety of works published in response to the poem. Pavlik knew some of these, too. Here, he recites a mashup of two of those poems. One is by R.W. Lillard and the other by C.B. Galbraith.
America's answer to those who made the supreme sacrifice is as follows. Rest ye in peace, ye Flanders dead, the fight that ye so bravely led. We've taken up and we will keep true faith with you who lie asleep in Flanders fields. With each across the mark your bed and poppies blowing overhead, for once your lifeblood ran red, so let your rest be sweet and deep in Flanders fields. Fear not that you have died for naught. The torch you threw to us we caught. Millions of hands are holding it high, and freedom's light shall never die, for we've learned the lesson that ye taught in Flanders fields. To fight it through, to crush the foe, or sleep with you in Flanders fields.
The poppies mentioned in these poems would later take on special significance, becoming the memorial flower that to this day commemorates military personnel who have died in war.
Ellen Brooks is the oral historian at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, the word elites has become one of the dirtiest words in American politics. Over the course of history, it's an idea that has been in place since the days of the founding fathers, who worried about an arrogant British king heaping abuse on ordinary Americans.
Today, the term and its prevailing definition have mostly been claimed by the conservative movement, with watershed moments coming in a 1964 speech by Ronald Reagan and in this attack ad aimed at Democrat Howard Dean.
What do you think of Howard Dean's plans to raise taxes on families by $1,900 a year?
What do I think? Well, I think Howard Dean should take his tax hiking, government expanding, latte drinking, sushi eating, Volvo driving, New York Times reading,
body piercing, Hollywood loving, left wing freak show back to Vermont, where it belongs.
Got it?
Club for Growth PAC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Beverly Gage is a historian at Yale University. She recently wrote about the history of the word elites for the New York Times. Beverly, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be here.
So looking back at that Howard Dean ad that we just heard, how does that fit into our idea of who the elites are?
Well, I think for a long time in American history, you know, the idea of an elite was of a group of people who held a lot of formal political power. Today, it tends to be more the idea of a cultural elite or a coastal elite or a liberal elite, people who have the kind of attributes that you saw listed there. They like sushi, they drink lattes, they drive Volvos, and that tends to be more of a cultural class, really, than a social class, necessarily.
Why is this such a powerful word to level at someone in American politics?
You know, that's one of the mysteries that I kind of wanted to get at in the piece that I was writing, that there, in some ways, the word elite is still a compliment. So when you use it as an adjective, you say, you know, that's an elite athlete, that's someone to aspire to be. But when it's used as this noun that you're an elite or the elites, it tends to sort of evoke this idea of people who are disconnected from ordinary life, people who like to tell other folks what to do, and that's really become its political meaning.
Now, there are some critiques embedded in that cultural definition of the term elites that, yeah, people on the left have identified with and said, yeah, maybe there are some things there that liberals need to own. Do you think that the liberal movement has ever really looked in the mirror and taken to task whether or not they consider that to be something they need to think about?
Right. Well, that is going to be a sort of interesting conversation over the next few years. I mean, if it is a conversation that develops, because like many political stereotypes, there's some measure of truth in all of this, right? And I think the place that it probably has the most meaning is in the idea that people tend to be kind of resistant to technocrats or policy elites who sort of look at things on paper and design policies for other people's lives without actually then reaching out to and getting to know the people whose lives this is going to affect. So that may, in fact, be a conversation that emerges, and that kind of conversation might actually be a productive one.
And you say that the term elites, it's got a lot of cultural currency today, but it seems like it goes all the way back to the founding fathers. So how did they see it?
Right. Well, so the founding fathers understood themselves to be rebelling against the concentrated power of a kind of monarchical elite. And then you've seen a lot of different populist rebellions of one sort or another throughout American history. So the Jacksonians, when Andrew Jackson came into power, they were rebelling against the founding fathers because at that point the founding fathers had become the kind of entrenched elite. And we saw this, of course, again in the late 19th century with the movement, the populist movement, that really gave us the word populist as a formal political category.
Was there ever a backlash against the prevailing idea of who elites were throughout the pages of history?
Well, there have been people who have critiqued and debated who deserves to be called an elite. So, say, in the 1950s and 1960s, sociologists, professors spent a lot of time trying to puzzle out who was a real American elite. Probably the most famous book from that moment was by a sociologist named C. Wright Mills, who wrote a book called The Power Elite. And to him, the power elite were all the people who were in charge of these giant new institutions that really were defining American life. So from the military to the government to the big new universities of the post-war years. But they were people who held real power. They made a decision. That decision affected other people's lives. And I think the puzzle now is how a kind of liberal professor at University of Wisconsin at Madison might be labeled an elite, but Donald Trump, a billionaire who is president of the United States, says that he's not one.
Well, Ronald Reagan seems like he was among those who birthed the word elites as an icon for the conservative movement in 1964. How did Reagan use that word?
Right. Reagan, I think, is really the person who crystallized elite as a cultural term, as a cultural idea. And for Reagan, you know, the cultural elite were, I believe he used the phrase, distant bureaucrats in Washington. Again, this idea that there were a bunch of people who were only interested, who went to the same schools, who were only interested in talking to each other, also known as the liberal establishment in that moment. That's who Reagan was really evoking when he used the word elite. And that's really the vision that has stuck, I think.
Does this word have a corollary that's used effectively by liberals at this moment in history?
Well, that is a really interesting question. So there are certainly plenty of choice words that liberals are throwing in the direction of the conservative movement at this point. At some point in history, one of the favorite words for liberals that was intended to kind of evoke this isolated elite sense was plutocrat, right, or a plutocracy or an oligarchy, right? So that used to be much more a part of our political language. I think today that doesn't have quite as much meaning.
It's not quite as catchy.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't really resonate with us anymore. And so I think a lot of the epithets going the other way, there are many of them, but I don't think they evoke quite the same image. Maybe the one percenters is the closest that we can get.
Beverly, thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Beverly Gage is a historian at Yale University. She wrote about the history of the term elites for the New York Times.
Coming up, we'll learn more about the political showdown over the vacant Supreme Court seat. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up after 7, it's Snap Judgment. Tonight's show is called Aces Wild. Snap throws down a four of a kind in front of a full house live. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, the battle over the open Supreme Court seat could reach a breaking point this week if Democrats in the Senate continue to challenge Republicans over President Trump's nominee, Judge Neil Gorsuch.
Democrats in the Senate say they don't believe he was fairly nominated and that if he can't secure enough votes, that he should be replaced with another nominee. While Republicans have threatened to go nuclear if the Senate doesn't approve him.
Kimmy King joins us now to talk about the political fight over the Supreme Court. She's a professor of political science at the University of North Texas in Denton. Kimmy, welcome back.
Always good to be with Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, Kimmy, what is the latest as of this afternoon in the fight over nominee Neil Gorsuch?
So it looks like so far the Democrats have been able to hold together a coalition that can at least engage in a filibuster. And what that would do would be to potentially stop the confirmation in its tracks. And so we are going to see what happens tomorrow. This is like one great big giant reality show happening.
Have you ever seen anything like this before, Kimmy?
So you have seen this kind of acrimony before, back with the Clarence Thomas appointment, and there was much bitterness over his nomination to fill the Thurgood Marshall seat. You also have seen Harry Reid back in 2013 invoke the nuclear option, as we call it, when you use the Senate's rules requiring a supermajority to close off debate. You saw that with Reid being so tired of what he said were Republicans blocking Obama nominees to the lower courts and to cabinet-level positions, that they did invoke a rule change. And so that's where this fight is coming from. Well, what I was going to say is that in terms of this kind of level of partisanship and having reached this point, the delay of game for a Supreme Court nominee, the senators being so bitterly divided and going against what is typically considered a collegial deliberative body rules, no, we've never seen that before.
I was going to ask if in the past it was considered not necessarily prerogative, there may have been debate, but that if a president appointed a nominee, that there was the sense that this is a presidential prerogative to put forth a nominee, and unless there was some glaring red flag, that nominee would be confirmed.
That is true. There is this little-known procedure called the blue slip, where the senator from the candidate's home state has the ability to block someone. But again, that was part of the Senate's collegial rules, that was put out there, that if you don't even have the support of the home team, then why should you be put forward? But in terms of what we're seeing here, there has just been this kind of use of, by any means necessary to block a nominee.
How much of the Democratic resistance that we've seen in the Senate do you think you can put down to the refusal of Republicans when it was the end of President Obama's term to give a hearing to Judge Merrick Garland?
Wow, I really wish I had a machine to see into the hearts, minds, and souls of members of Congress to see what they are thinking. I will tell you what judicial scholars say about Gorsuch's record, and that is that he is not nearly the conservative that he has been portrayed to be. He has conservative values, but in terms of his opinions, there is plenty there for both sides to be pleased about. I think in a different time, Gorsuch would have had no trouble. We need to recall that there was no Democratic opposition when he was appointed to his initial federal judgeship. And I think that's critical. So if I have to give you my best professional guess, I'm going to say it's about a 65-35 split, that this is a function of the problems inside our government and the divided partisan nature that we've sort of all fallen into.
Well, you have maybe the rancor and the divided partisan nature. Is there also perhaps pressure from constituents who don't want to see maybe Democrats yield on this one?
Oh, absolutely. And there is great symbolic value in a Supreme Court nominee. Let's not forget that given the age of the justices right now, the next president is probably going to be able to make between 3 to 4 appointments, depending on how long they stay on. In terms of overall age, most of the justices now were appointed, in the age range of around their 50s. Now, Clarence Thomas, again, a very acrimonious debate, was one of the youngest at 43. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was among the oldest, being into her 60s. And so it's against that backdrop that you have to evaluate what it is that the senators are focusing on, because they're trying to put it into that tradition. And that's why everybody's jockeying for position. I saw a very interesting statistic that the 43 senators opposing Gorsuch comprise 53% of the population. And with the midterm elections in 2018, everyone is going to want to be able to say they supported the good side.
We're talking with Kimmy King right now from the University of North Texas in Denton, looking at the procedure moving forward for the confirmation or lack of confirmation of Judge Neil Gorsuch. And let's hear from one of the legislators himself now. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York said that he couldn't in good conscience vote for Gorsuch. And here's what he said on the Senate floor.
After careful deliberation, I have concluded that I cannot support Judge Neil Gorsuch's nomination to the Supreme Court. His nomination will have a cloture vote. He will have to earn 60 votes for confirmation. My vote will be no, and I urge my colleagues to do the same. To my Republican friends who think that if Judge Gorsuch fails to reach 60 votes, we ought to change the rules, I say, if this nominee cannot earn 60 votes, a bar met by each of President Obama's nominees and George Bush's last two nominees, the answer isn't to change the rules. It's to change the nominee.
And we have a quote, long quote there, from Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, who's saying, in effect, let's not look at the nuclear option, let's get a different nominee. But how likely is that to happen if you're on the Republican side of things and you want to see this this nominee confirmed?
So this is going to be the $64,000 question, and how much of a divide, how much of a splintering can the Democrats possibly invoke? I think it's important to clarify that the reason for that, I mean, I think many people look at this issue of the filibuster, and it's a kind of strange rule that in essence says to close off debate, you have to have 60 members. It's a supermajority rule. But that to actually vote on something and to have it carry, you only need 51, a simple majority. And the idea behind the vote of cloture is that you want to try to have this kind of collegiality, that you need to have higher, you don't want to just barely meet the mark, you need to exceed the mark. And so that's what Schumer is pointing to. I think the concern that the Republicans should have is much of the same concern that they raised back when it was done in 2013, that it creates a dangerous precedent that then they will have to be held to. I think one of the things for your listeners that are keenly interested tomorrow is whether or not Pence will have to jump into it, because they have a 52-48 split right now. But if they can start to nibble away at even a majority vote, that's when it starts to get interesting and possible for changing the nominee, as Schumer is suggesting.
So what would Pence's role be?
So he has a tie-breaking vote as the presiding officer inside the Senate. And so it's when they come down to a 50-50 split that he is able to jump into the fray and break that split. And so that's why it's important and it matters.
Kimmy, what do you think is at stake for both Democrats and Republicans should the Republican side of this process decide to do as President Obama did with lower court nominees, to go for the nuclear option and to get rid of the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees?
So the danger in that is that it is another nail in the coffin of the collegial measures that the Senate has always traditionally resorted to. Remember that if you can't meet the 60-vote requirement, even one member of the Senate can just yap on for forever and it will eventually kill it. But the problem here is that it's so closely divided, and that if this precedent is created, then it's going to continue to be a war going forward, because as long as everyone keeps looking in the rearview mirror, they're not paying attention to the accident in the highway up ahead that they're going to have to navigate. And I think that's why you see scholars all over the place, both those that support Gorsuch and those that are opposed to him, saying that in some way it is the playing for rules here that is the real danger, because a Supreme Court nominee serves for life, and that's part of the concern.
We're talking with Kimmy King right now. She's a professor of political science at the University of North Texas in Denton. And we've been talking about the ongoing battle over Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Democrats' attempt to stall the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch? Should he be confirmed? Or do you think the seat should have gone to Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're continuing our conversation about the political fight over the vacant Supreme Court seat and President Trump's nominee, Neil Gorsuch. Kimmy King stays with us. She's a professor of political science at the University of North Texas in Denton.
And you can join the conversation. What do you think about the politics involved in the Supreme Court? Should Neil Gorsuch be confirmed? Do you think that President Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland, should have been confirmed last year? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post your comments on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Kimmy, I've got some callers for you, but first let's hear from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, who doubled down on his support of Gorsuch and also his take on the Democrats over their stance. Here he is.
Judge Gorsuch, as you know, is extraordinarily well qualified. It's almost amusing to watch our Democratic friends try to come up with some rationale for opposition. Several have suggested that a Supreme Court justice needs to get 60 votes. In fact, I think you already know, no Supreme Court justice has ever been stopped with a partisan filibuster. There was one rather unusual exception, the Fortas nomination in 1968, ironically in the middle of a presidential election year, in which both sides collaborated to stop the nomination. So no Supreme Court justice has ever been stopped with a partisan filibuster. That is obviously what the Democratic leader has announced they will do. We are optimistic that they will not be successful in keeping this good man from joining the Supreme Court very soon.
And Kimmy, what do you hear in that quote from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell?
I think you hear the majority leader doing what any good majority leader for a party that is splintered is doing, and that is reminding everyone that if we are going to pick up the pieces and move this forward, then there needs to be a position that is to be taken. I think everyone is in universal agreement that should the process and the rules be changed, that it does set a precedent that will be of concern for future generations. And it also indicates a greater willingness to break the rules because of partisanship, or break what has historically been considered to be the rule. And maybe that's just the nature of our society because we're changing. There are some who have said, hey, you know what, we can't all get along, and this is just power politics, and welcome to it, and we just have to get used to the new world and the new world order that we're facing.
We'll take a caller now. We've got Chris joining us first in Columbus. Chris, hi.
Hi, great show as usual.
Thank you.
I have to say that if you look at his credentials, Mr. Gorsuch's actual education credentials are almost identical, if not surpassing, Sonia Sotomayor's, and that confirmation hearing, while some objections were raised, went through without real political opposition, and this should be no different. And the Democrats, and I call on Senator Baldwin, who, when she was part of the Wisconsin legislature, worked with people in forming consensuses, she needs to actually set forth some leadership in this and come together so that the rules are not changed.
Chris, thank you for that thought there. And Chris getting at, he wants to see there to be cooperation, that collegiality, Kimmy, that you were getting at earlier. Is he going to get it? Is this maybe a game of very, very high stakes chicken, and that both sides will maybe return to form?
Yeah, and I'm not sure, where we go from here. I mean, the fact of the matter is we've increasingly been acrimonious about it. If you look back, the Roberts appointment was a 78-22, but let's look at Samuel Alito. There was much, grief over him. He passed 58-42, right? So you had enough to close off the cloture, and he was still able to be appointed. Most people consider Alito to be, maybe to the right of Scalia in some ways in the approach that he has taken so far. your caller's point is also very correct, that people looking over the Gorsuch credentials have highlighted that he has superior credentials, that this is a man who would have otherwise been accepted. And in fact, relative to some of the other Trump nominees that were being considered by the administration, Gorsuch doesn't have that hard-line conservative ideology that many Democrats have ranted about.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for that call. And we go next to Brian in Albany. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
I completely disagree with the last caller. Nobody is questioning Gorsuch's credentials. That's not the issue. It's whether she can get a vote, because the Republicans blocked Merrick Garland for 11 months. If they want to go with the nuclear option, get rid of the filibuster, that's great. That's fantastic. Let them screw themselves when they're in the minority. All they do is play these games. Over and over and over again. They like to sit here and threaten to go the nuclear option with the filibuster when they're in power, but when they're in the minority, they break all records.
Brian, thank you for your thoughts. And you hear, Brian, that pressure from voters that Democrats may feel that their voters want them to block this appointment, and some of them are rising to that challenge. But for Dems, you know, is there a price tag? For instance, the Democrats, or could Democrats, Kimmy, if the nuclear option goes through, could they lose the chance to block other appointments that could be even higher stakes further down the road?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons why you've seen some Democrats say that we just simply cannot reach that point, right? And that there will be payback on this. You know, the one caller had mentioned Sotomayor's record, and there was much fear at the time of Sotomayor because our now Attorney General Jeff Sessions absolutely criticized Sotomayor over comments that she had made and statements she had made about discrimination. And it mirrors in some way the acrimony that you've seen leveled at Gorsuch about his physician-assisted suicide writings, that it shows he's really pro-life and he's showing his real colors and all of that. So the problem, your second caller is again making a very valid point, that people are kind of tired of the messing with the rules to achieve your partisan purpose. And, you know, you can't complain about Harry Reid and what the senators did back in 2013 with getting rid of the filibuster. And then McConnell comes along and wants to do the same thing, but he now ups the ante and makes it for Supreme Court nominees, not just the federal district and lower court positions. So this is problematic. We got to figure out a way to start talking to each other and with each other and not past each other. And I think that's what many people feel is missing in this debate.
Let's take another call here. We've got Jim in Rice Lake with us. Jim, hi.
Hi. I'd like to comment. I think your guest is kind of either an advocate or an apologist for the Republicans. Pointing out, I'm an attorney, and she pointed out that there was no opposition to Gorsuch on a lower court level. She knows, or should know, that there's very little controversy usually in these appointments, because lower court judges follow the law. They don't make it. Because I teach law, and as I tell my students, what the Constitution means is what five out of nine people say it means on a Monday morning. And secondly, her comment that she can't look into the minds of the Democratic senators as to the obstructionist conduct of the Republican Party as a motivation to pay back the Merrick Garland unprecedented obstruction, I think is intellectually dishonest.
And Jim, I'm going to leave it there. I want to make sure Kimmy gets a chance to respond to all that. Kimmy,
and it's
ahead.
A very fair point. I appreciate your point, absolutely. The reality is, though, that when you look at these things, lower court nominees do pass through, and perhaps it highlights the fact that there ought to be more of a vetting. And if there really is this concern, then why was this not raised back in 2013? And if we're going to continue to have obstructionism, should we have a conversation about how to go through a candidate's record more thoroughly at the lower court so that when they get to this high level, you're not doing this again? I certainly don't want to come across as an apologist for the Republican Party, but I think there's plenty of room here for blame to go around when people begin being critical of persons. One thing that's very fair.
And we're almost out of time,
yeah,
Kimmy.
Good.
Just a few
seconds. One last
seconds.
Point I want to say: if you look at what Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor went through, I'm going to put a gender bend on this. If you look at the kind of the way in which they were raked over the coals in a number of ways. There are some people who've made the argument that Gorsuch didn't get as much of a beating up as he should have had compared to what they did to
Kagan. And we leave it there. Kimmy King, always a pleasure to have you on. Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas in Denton, joining us to talk about the political fight over the Supreme Court.